Today is Friday, June 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
Whether it's girls married as children or boys married as children, when that happens, they invariably become parents. So we have children being parents, which is far from ideal.
A new report released today by UNICEF finds that an estimated 115 million boys and men around the world were married as children. Also ahead, Mexican officials return to the negotiating table today to find a way to stem the flow of Central American migrants across the U.S. southern border. And British Prime Minister Theresa May steps down as leader of the Conservative Party. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the United States still plans to make good on a threat to impose 5% tariffs on Mexican goods on Monday, despite progress in border security negotiations that entered their third day today. White House spokeswoman Sarah Sanders said today U.S. and Mexican negotiators have made a lot of progress over the course of the last few days. But as of now, we're still on track for tariffs on Monday. Sanders' latest warning was made to reporters aboard Air Force One in Ireland as President Donald Trump prepared to return to the U.S. U.S. and Mexican officials returned to the negotiating table today to find a way to stem the flow of Central American migrants across the U.S. southern border that is threatening trade between the neighboring countries. The U.S. pushed Mexico yesterday to do more to curb the migrant surge, with Trump renewing his threat of tariffs on Mexican imports next week if no agreement is reached. Well, British Prime Minister Theresa May steps down as leader of the Conservative Party today, and the first round of voting to elect her successor is expected next week. May will remain in the post until a new leader is chosen, likely by the end of July, but she relinquished control over the direction of Britain's departure from the EU, scheduled for October 31st. The next prime minister will have less than 5 months to decide whether to try to revive May's plan and delay Brexit once again, or leave the EU with no agreement at all. For more, here's Charles de Ledesma.
Theresa May steps down as leader of a party in turmoil and a country in limbo, half in, half out of the EU. May will be remembered as the latest in a long line of Conservative leaders destroyed by the party's divisions over Europe, and as a prime minister who failed in her primary mission to leave the EU. But history could also see her as a leader who faced hard odds with stubborn determination. Before her period as PM, May had served for 6 years as Home Secretary, responsible for borders, immigration and law and order, soon to establish a reputation for solid competence and a knack for vanquishing flashier rivals. Charles de Ledesma, London.
Well, the U.S. and Russian militaries accused each other of unsafe actions today after an American-guided missile cruiser and a Russian destroyer came within 50 meters of each other in the East China Sea. The U.S. 7th Fleet said the Russian destroyer put the safety of the USS Chancellorsville and its crew at risk, forcing it to reverse all engines at full throttle to avoid a collision. It said a helicopter that was operating at sea was preparing to land on the Chancellorsville, which was traveling on a steady course, when the Russian destroyer traveling behind the U.S. ship speeded up and approached as close as 50 to 100 feet or 15 to 30 meters. Clay Doss, spokesman for the Japan-based 7th Fleet, said no one was injured and he was not aware of any damage to the ship. The Russian military accused the Chancellorsville of making a dangerous maneuver by crossing the path of the Russian destroyer, Admiral Vinogradov.
Naval officers say the Russian destroyer put the safety of the USS Chancellorsville and its crew at risk, forcing it to reverse all engines at full throttle to avoid a collision. A helicopter that was operating at sea was preparing to land on the Chancellorsville at the time when the Russian boat traveling behind the US ship speeded up and approached as close as 50 to 100 feet. For its part, the Russian military is accusing the American ship of making a dangerous maneuver by crossing the path of the destroyer craft. I'm Charles Ledesma.
Among the top stories in the world, Australian police seized the nation's largest haul of methamphetamines in a shipment at the Melbourne waterfront. Dr. John, the legendary pianist and musician who mixed black and white musical influences, is being remembered. His family said he died yesterday of a heart attack. He was 77 years old. And a German nurse is expected to spend the rest of his life in prison for killing 85 hospital patients in what is believed to be the worst killing spree in Germany's post-war history. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
For years, conventional wisdom suggested that eating red meats would increase blood cholesterol levels more than eating white meats, such as poultry. A new study led by researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, suggests that both white and red meats have the same effects on blood cholesterol levels. The study, published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, also found evidence that eating either red or white meats for protein resulted in higher cholesterol readings than consuming non-meat proteins such as vegetables, dairy, and legumes. In recent years, people hoping to lower their cholesterol levels and risk of heart disease avoided eating red meat in favor of poultry or non-meat products. High cholesterol levels is considered a major risk factor for heart disease. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
In its first in-depth analysis of child grooms, a new UNICEF report finds that an estimated 115 million boys and men around the world were married as children. Of these, 1 in 5 children, or 23 million, were married before the age of 15. Using data from 82 countries, the study reveals that child marriage among boys is prevalent across a range of countries around the world, spanning sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America and the Caribbean, South Asia and East Asia, and the Pacific. James Elder is the UNICEF Eastern and Southern Africa Chief of Communications. He spoke with me about the significance of the report.
We always see these very large numbers, and this one shows us that 115 million boys and men around the world were actually married when they were children. I guess the significance in a couple of parts. One is that reminding we again having large segments of our society who will be so critical as adults, having their childhood stolen from them when they're children. The other is that whether it's girls married as children or boys married as children, when that happens, they invariably become parents. So we have children being parents, which is far from ideal for either, you know, the married children or, of course, those they bring into the world. And then the last one is just the economic impact of all of this. It's very, very clear now that if you want to break the cycle of poverty, quality education is everything. When children, in this case boys, get married, they tend to leave school. The argument is right in practice and right in principle not to marry children is very clear in this one. There's a strong economic argument as to why children should be able to be exactly that, just kids.
And also, it was revealed that the top countries are Central African Republic, Nicaragua, and Madagascar. So would this be a cultural thing where families force the sons to marry?
Exactly. There seems that the study, as you said, is so fresh that there's still a lot of questions around what are the influences. But by and large, I think they're probably the same as they are for girls. And the girls' numbers are incredible. I think 750 million girls. We always talk about people living in the moment. This minute as you and I speak, there's something like 22 girls are married as children every single minute. Now, the reasons for this, yes, exactly. They're around the perception that somehow marriage will provide protection, you know, family honour, and a lot of things around social norms and customary or religious laws that sort of condone or promote these practices.
How do you go about changing this tradition? What is the first thing that needs to be done, the first step?
I guess the first step always is legislation. You've got to have the right laws in place. And yet we know as well that there are a lot of countries with good laws in place and they're not followed. So, but legislation is a starting point. But then you've got to be able to have a conversation and be able to listen in those communities. That's what UNICEF seeks to do in wherever we are all around the world. When you're in these communities, invariably rural, you need to understand the position of the traditional or religious place people are coming from and listen to that and then try and have a conversation about, you know, everyone's got a similar ambition here to to build the strength of that society, and that's going to be completely undermined, marrying off your youngest people, your biggest resource, when they are children.
Also, most of these studies in child marriage has really been focused on the female, on young girls. So why has there been such little information up until now, I guess, on boys?
I don't really know. I think that so many of these things come back to numbers. You do need to have the data there. You need to have the evidence. Now, this evidence will have all come from civil registration, from understanding countries when people have been married. So, in fact, to segue a little bit, probably the 150 million you talked about is probably way less than the real numbers because a lot of marriages aren't actually recorded. But why haven't we known for now? Yeah, it just hasn't been examined. There's been such a focus on girl marriage, which is rightly so. That is very dangerous for girls. They're dangerous to their health, dangerous to any potential they have, and dangerous for the youngest people they end up bringing into the world. But this study certainly examines the idea about the detriment to boys in terms of them losing job opportunities and, again, starting families. So it is, as you say, very embryonic and another reminder of just how much work there is to do, particularly in parts of the world where populations are growing. And it's even more important that kids do stay on, do get that quality education. We know that for every year you stay at school, wages can increase by about 10% a year in sub-Saharan Africa. So it's very important that this conversation is had. But yes, as we said earlier, it takes a lot to change it.
That was James Elder, UNICEF Eastern and Southern Africa Chief of Communications. He spoke with me from Nairobi. While the UN Security Council discussed the crisis in Sudan after the ruling military council used deadly force to clear the main protest site in Khartoum, which left up to 100 people dead, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the use of excessive force against civilians. The Security Council tried to condemn the killing of civilians, but Russia and China blocked the attempt. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy about that lack of unity, what it might mean for the Sudanese protest, and what it could be next for the country.
The main thing it means is that symbolically there isn't a universal condemnation of the military crackdown. But I don't think it surprises too many people because China and Russia are happy to try to endorse authoritarian governments wherever possible. They don't want to give credence to these popular uprisings. And so I don't think the fact that Russia and China are blocking this carries a lot of weight. I think what will be more important now is what happens internally to the country and what African regional bodies say and do. The African Union Peace and Security Council issued a strong condemnation of the military crackdown and has repeatedly said they expect a transition to a civilian-led government. And so I think the pressure on the military will continue regardless of what happened at the Security Council.
What are the possible scenarios for Sudan with no negotiations between the military council and the protesters?
Well, I think this is what still needs to be decided. The military has taken a decision that they think they can force their will on the people of Sudan. And Russia and other statements are just trying to give them some sort of diplomatic cover. But clearly, the military junta does not have any legitimacy for the actions that they're taking. They don't have any claim on authority or legitimacy for governing in Sudan. And they know that. And therefore, you know, they want to try to hold elections in as quick a time as possible to provide some sort of fig leaf to substantiate their rule. By doing it in a short period of time, of course, it plays into the interest of those who already hold a lot of the levers of power, and that means those who are tied to the military. But I think it needs to be understood that by taking violent action against protesters, and, you know, latest reports are more than 100 people have been killed, many hundreds more have been arrested, the military now owns all of the problems that Sudan faces, you know, all of the grievances that led to the protest in the first place, you know, the 70% inflation, the stagnant economy, the high unemployment, the $55 billion in foreign debt. The military now owns those problems. and they're not going to get any better. And so as those economic pressures build up, the military is going to be hard-pressed to be able to resolve it without international support and without a civilian-led technocratic government. So they're going to be under pressure to try to forge some sort of way forward with civilian representatives as this moves forward.
Some observers detected that the military council resorted to disperse the protesters after consultations with the leaders of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. What do you make of that?
Well, many observers feel there's a direct link between those meetings and the decision to crack down on the protesters. And clearly, this shows that there is a regional influence at play in Sudan. The Saudi Arabia and UAE have provided $250 million to the military junta to try to keep them in place or try to help stabilize the situation, at least in the short term. But I think what it says is that these Gulf countries are afraid of creating a precedent where there is a popular representation and a popular will on and creating some sort of democratic governance. And I think it terrifies them. And I think they really push the military to take action. Unfortunately, it seems that they're not thinking about the longer-term consequences of this. It really holds the potential to become a very volatile and unstable situation in Sudan, which will, of course, be very harmful for the population. But in the end, it's going to be destabilizing for the region as well.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, music lovers. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. This week's edition brings you music, tributes, and stories of a legend, Leo Sarkisian. He passed away June 8, 2018. The VOA Music Man founded Music Time in Africa in 1965. He always, alongside his beloved wife Mary, animated the homes and warmed the hearts of millions of African listeners for nearly 50 years with his music radio show. So don't miss it, Leo's final send-off. This Sunday and the following Saturday at 15:05 and 20:05 Universal Time.
The United Nations is demanding an immediate end to indiscriminate attacks against civilians and civilian infrastructure in northwest Syria, warning the warring parties their actions might amount to war crimes. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN agencies say an intense military escalation by Russian-backed Syrian forces and armed rebels in northwest Syria is having a catastrophic impact on the civilian population. They confirm at least 160 civilians have been killed and hundreds more wounded in fighting over recent weeks. They say 3 million people in Idlib need protection and 300,000 civilians who have fled their homes in the past 2 months are in imminent danger. Spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says civilians and civilian infrastructure are coming under daily attack by airstrikes, artillery shelling, and barrel bombs.
Since the 28th of April, there have been 25 confirmed attacks on healthcare in the northwest, including on 24 health facilities and one ambulance. Two of the attack health facilities were hit more than once, and at least six health workers have been killed.
Laerke says healthcare facilities are fully protected under international humanitarian law. He says it is illegal to target them. He tells VOA few health facilities remain intact to care for the sick and wounded.
Already before the recent months of escalation, the status of healthcare in Syria at large, and in particular in Idlib, was already appalling. Even though that facilities have not been hit, they fear that they may be hit. So the doctors, the healthcare personnel are leaving, the patients are not going to those hospitals, understandably.
Laerke says aid agencies are providing food and health services through mobile clinics to people who are newly displaced in northwest Syria. He notes many schools in the region also have been attacked, so he says catch-up classes are being provided for thousands of children who have been out of school since May. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The 2019 Atlantic hurricane season is officially underway, yet many people haven't recovered from some of last year's storms. Meantime, tornadoes have torn up swaths of several U.S. states in the past few weeks, while floodwaters wreaked even more damage. All of this has a psychological toll, as VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
Across the U.S. and elsewhere, too, tornadoes, flooding, and fires have destroyed homes, sometimes entire communities. Preston Black in Oklahoma says a tornado threw his trailer home several meters into the air. His parents, wife, and children were all inside. Then he saw his wife in the debris.
It was awful, the worst thing I could ever see.
She survived, but they lost everything they had. Hurricane Michael destroyed entire towns in Florida last October. Some people are still living in tents. Janelle Crosby lives in a trailer home full of health hazards.
Cats, critters, it's disgusting. Mold, this they put up to try to keep the mold. You see how pink is now black.
Natural disasters affect everyone differently. In California, Gwen Osh found the immediate impact of loss can't always be anticipated.
I didn't realize how much my home means to me.
Dr. John Lauriello, a psychiatrist at the University of Missouri Healthcare, says when an entire community is hit by disaster, there's more support than when an individual suffers a tragedy.
I think there's a shared understanding of the trauma, which I think can be very, very helpful because people feel like it wasn't just them who it occurred to their community, and therefore the community is going to work together and the rebuilding will happen together. So it's a big difference between having a single house fire and having multiple homes destroyed in a tornado.
In Missouri, universities are housing people whose homes were destroyed by a tornado and massive flooding. Daryl Bonner says he's grateful.
It's a blessing living here. It's a lot of financial burden have been, let loose a little bit. There's hope, there's people out there that's willing to help,
Crosby says in her Florida community, people share whatever they have.
We just all take care of each other. It's hard, but like I said earlier, if one of us have generator gas, we all have a fan, or if we have propane, then we all get to cook that night. If not, we get out here and make fires in the grill and cook. The ways that we're surviving, and I feel like it's going to get easier, but I just feel like it's going to take a while.
Psychiatrist Lane Young Walker at the University of Missouri Healthcare says the sooner parents can get their children back into a normal routine, the better off they will be.
So when a natural disaster like this happens and they get displaced, they're not in their home anymore, their school is closed, they're not able to go to the school, they don't have that structure, they don't have that routine and that consistency, and it can cause a lot of stress for them.
If schools are destroyed, Young Walker suggests finding ways for children to do classwork.
Can you give me an antonym for the word gradually?
Last year, a teacher turned her California home into a classroom when her student's school was destroyed by fire. 8-year-old Eleanor Wettig thought it was better than...
I love it. It's like more comfortable than our classroom. The chairs are cushy. That's one thing that I like. And anyway, it's a house, so it's like more fancy and stuff. And she cooks us great lunches. Like every lunch, I love.
Californian Gwen Osh credits community support with helping people who had lost their homes during the wildfires.
It's almost like a therapy thing, We're all in the same place and dealing with the same thing. So, we're talking about the people who lost their homes and how sad it is. But you know what? We're resilient.
Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.